Hudson Taylor, In Early Years, The Growth of the Soul, Chapter 30, On Whom the Mantle Fell, June to July, 1856. 6 months of intercourse with William Burns had now gone by, and little as either of them expected it, they were nearing the close of their helpful, happy fellowship. To them it seemed, on the contrary, that their work together was only just beginning. The needs around them were so great, and the help they were to one another so evident, that they could not but look forward to doing something really adequate together by the blessing of God for the important region to which he had called them. But Chateau was only one needy field out of the vast whole of unreached China. For that wider work to be done, the Lord was making preparations, as well as for widespread blessing in the region. He had specially laid upon their hearts William Burns for Chateau and other strategic points in the great seaboard provinces, and Hudson Taylor by and by for far-reaching inland China. Such was the purpose of him who sees the end from the beginning. So the days of the pilgrimage together drew to a close, filled as all that went before had been with helpful fellowship in the Lord. By this time it was the middle of June, and more than ever trying in the little rooms over the incense shop. It seemed really imperative to get other quarters, and as this was out of the question of Chateau, they extended the search to neighboring towns and villages. It is much more difficult to itinerate here than it was around Shanghai, Hudson Taylor wrote to his father on June 16th. There the boat one traveled in supplied a home. Here it is not so, excepting in places so near at hand that we should naturally return at night. We must go in most cases on foot, not knowing where or how you will pass the night, and ready to take such accommodations as may offer. It is, of course, an entirely new line of things for me, and requires far more faith and self-denial than anything I have hitherto known. But we have the promise that his grace shall be sufficient for us, and we know that in our weakness he will perfect his strength. All this was of the greatest importance for one who was to be the leader of an evangelistic pioneering mission. It was needful that he should have a practical, intimate knowledge of many phases of life and work, and to this end his chateau experiences were well and wisely chosen, difficult as they seemed at the time. On one of these overland journeys, for example, he was brought to the point of having nowhere at all to shelter for the night, a serious position in China. It was in the little town of T-O-P-U. Whether he had gone on May 20 to take possession of a cottage, they had been enabled to rent one room below and one above, in the more open surroundings of this country place, promised welcome relief from their overcrowded city quarters. But all unwittingly, they were reckoning without their hosts. For the landlord, who had been willing to have them the day before, met Mr. Taylor on his arrival, saying, go back at once. My neighbors will not allow me to let you have the house. A moment's prayer, however, satisfied Mr. Taylor that he must not go back, and dismissing his boat accordingly, he went about his master's business. His servant, who knew the character of the T-I-E-C-H-I-U people, kept asking anxiously, what will you do? Where shall we go when darkness comes on? We cannot stay out all night. Footnote. An account of danger from evil men, not to mention the malaria climate. End of footnote. Never fear, was the quiet answer. The Lord knows, and he will provide. So in temple and tea shop and along the busy streets, the young missionary gave books to all who could read them and deliver his message. Rarely had his heart been so filled with the joy of the Lord in this work, and people noticed it. Where are you going to sleep, they asked, as the inwardness of the situation became generally known. That I cannot tell you, he frankly replied, but my Heavenly Father knows. He is everywhere present, and never forgets the needs of his people, nor does he ever leave them unsupplied. Are you not anxious least you should get into trouble. Now, I'm not anxious, he was able to say with a smile. My heart is in perfect peace, because the Lord will provide. And so it proved, his own letter continued. I went on distributing books and talking with the people until dark, and then was invited to sleep over a barber shop, the owner of which was a Ha-Ka, that's H-A-K-A man, with congee, rice and water gruel, was prepared, and of this we made our supper. In the evening, a great many people came to see me, one man bringing a present of two very pretty, fragrant flowers. I pointed out to my visitors that the beauty and sweetness of these flowers was given them by God, that birds and insects are all cared for by Him, that the many blessings enjoyed even by those who know Him not and sin against Him by worshiping idols, the work of their own hands, are still given and continued by His grace. And how much more may the children of this Heavenly Father look to Him with confidence, knowing He will supply their every need in life and death and in the world to come. I was much blessed in soul and greatly helped in testifying to the love and care of God. It is curious, one man remarks, how he speaks of God in connection with all things. Poor people, truly of them it may be said, God is not in all their thoughts. But the little town of Topu had the opportunity at this time of really understanding the message that had awakened so much interest. For Mr. Burns came over the next day and stayed almost a fortnight, though his companion had to return to Chateau. Later, in the month June, two Chinese Christians joined them, sent by a missionary friend in Hong Kong. They were natives of the TIE-CHIU district, and after a brief visit to their homes upcountry, were to remain with and assist Mr. Burns, who was greatly needing such helpers. And the first work with which he entrusted them was the search for a room that could be used for a street chapel. As natives of the place, he knew they were more likely to be successful than foreigners. But do what they would, no premises of any kind could be obtained. Realizing afresh, through their unsuccessful search, the value of the footing they had already, Mr. Burns and his companion were more than ever thankful for their little home over the incense shop, in spite of discomforts that only seemed to multiply with the heat of summer. Some idea of these minor trials may be obtained from a lively passage in a letter from Hudson Taylor to his younger sister, written about this time. Chateau, June 9, 1856. My dear Louisa, I must try to answer your note by this mail, or run the risk of leaving it undone. And this I hope to accomplish, if the mosquitoes, flies, cockroaches, 2 inches long and flying about in all directions, centipedes, lizards, crickets, fleas, and all the rest of the tormentors will allow. While writing these few lines, I have made one successful and two unsuccessful attacks upon as many fleas, so you may imagine how plentiful they are. Sometimes I stop in the middle of a sentence, catch 3 or 4 of these unwelcome visitors, kill a few cockroaches, and then go on again. The other night I felt something very strange inside my Chinese garment, and on looking to see what it was, found a centipede 2 or 3 inches long. It bit me severely before I could eject it, and the place swelled up and was very painful. But I applied carbonate of ammonium with immediate relief. The people of the house made a great stir about it. These bites are very venomous, and soon brought in a hen. For what purpose, I do not know. But I sent the poor creature away, explaining the virtues of my white powder, at which they looked respectfully enough. It was well that I had some. Father's medicine chest has been about the most valuable thing I brought to China. The rest of the letter is in a more serious strain, for the spiritual welfare of this dear sister was much upon his heart. He was just leaving school to take up the more leisurely life of home, and as he thought of the opportunities and special dangers this would present, he longed to safeguard her as well as at that distance he was able. If you want blessing, he had written in an earlier letter, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and you will be on the high road to all other good. Some people forget this and seek happiness in the world, but it eludes their grasp. They think plan, contrive, and try this means and that, but get no nearer the mark. While there are others who, seeking nothing for themselves, have joy and peace poured into their hearts. For they put first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things are added to them. This I have proved by my own experience, and I can assure you that so it is. Pray earnestly, perseveringly, till your prayers are answered, to be truly made a child of God. Then remember you are his, but still a child. Your Father knows best where you should be and how. So ask to do his will as the true, the only way to happiness and content. Remember, too, when saved, you are his servant. All you possess is his. Use it as such. If, as his servants, you are true to Christ, he, as your master, will provide for you, and that liberally. It is the principle of any concern who has the burden of responsibility. So avoid seeking to be head. Be the servant and child in all things. Look for guidance and commit your way to the Lord. Thus you will prosper in temporal as in spiritual things, and avoid those grinding cares which wear one down more than actual labor, and sometimes makes life itself a burden. And remember to pray for your absent brother, who finds it much easier to tell you what to do than to act it out himself. But he does try to do so, and can tell you that he has never tried altogether in vain, for if he has not come up to the mark, he is always blessed in his own soul for trying. Another paragraph from the same letter is well worth quoting. There is one thing I would specially warn you against, one of the greatest curses, I believe, of the present day, the practice of novel reading. If you value your mind and soul, avoid it as you would a dangerous serpent. I cannot tell you what I would give to be able to forget certain novels I have read, and to efface their influence from my memory. And I firmly believe, though some would deny it, that no Christian ever did or ever will read them without injury, very serious injury, too, if the habit is indulged in. It is like opium smoking, and begets a craving for more that must be supplied. Better books are neglected, and no one can estimate the mischief that results. Few, I believe, could honestly ask God's blessing upon the reading of a novel, and few would venture to assert that they read them to the glory of God. I dread them for you, especially as a temptation to which you are constitutionally disposed, for you and I resemble one another very much as to temperament. The only safety lies in avoiding them as one of Satan's most subtle snares. I often fear that while I may be remembered by you as your brother, the missionary in China, you will not feel towards me as to one who has a deep, a constant, and increasing interest in your welfare. May God bless you, my dearly beloved and often prayed for sister, and make you all that he himself would have you be. Good night. My oil is done. Once more, God bless you. This was the summer of disastrous floods, when in the low-lying parts of the TIE-CHIU district, several cities were inundated and more than 200 towns and villages. The rice crop, just ready for reaping, was swept away in many places by the tremendous rush of water that even unearthed coffins and carried them out to sea. Not a few lives were lost, and the distress among all classes was very great. Mr. Burns returned in the middle of June from the neighboring towns of AM-PO, where he had been living for 10 days. He only came just in time, for the house he had been unable to rent was flooded breast high the following day. He had had an encouraging stay in this busy, important place, a larger town than Swatow, though not so crowded. Not only was there a constant stream of visitors coming for books and conversation, but several interested neighbors were regularly attending morning and evening worship. The change back to Swatow was not a little trying, especially as the continued downpour prevented outside work. But it gave a welcome opportunity for prayer and conference over many problems connected with their position. By the close of the week, Mr. Taylor was far from well. The time confinement to their narrow quarters was telling upon him, especially when, with their servants and two native helpers, they were so thick on the ground as he expressed it. The dark, rainy weather has a depressing effect on one's spirits, he wrote. I do not feel very well, but trust that in a few days a change of weather will put things right and let me go on with my work again. Brighter days came, and Mr. Byrne was able to return to AM-PO with his Chinese helpers, but not until it had become evident that he must bid farewell to his English companion for a time. The greatest heat of summer was still before them, and Mr. Taylor was in no condition to meet it under existing circumstances. Providential indications also were not lacking that for the good of the work he ought to pay a visit to Shanghai. Disappointed as they were about premises for a chapel, their thoughts had naturally turned to other methods of evangelization. The people of Chateau were far too suspicious of foreigners to let them have a room for nothing but preaching. How could anyone be willing to pay the rent of a shop merely to have a place for talking in about religious doctrines? Clearly, there must be something behind such a proceeding, but premises for medical work would be quite another matter. The foreign doctor was always persona grata, and if he must tell more or less about his religion, well, his medicines were so good that the preaching could be tolerated. This being so, even in Chateau, Mr. Burns and Mr. Taylor had almost decided to begin hospital work, or at any rate to open a dispensary. They were still praying about it, wondering whether the latter should take the long journey to Shanghai to fetch his instruments and medicines, when the chief mandarin of the place was taken ill, and the native doctors were unable to relieve him. Hearing from a friend that one of the foreigners in native dress was a skillful physician, he sent for Hudson Taylor and put the case into his hands. The treatment proved beneficial, and no sooner was he well himself than he strongly advised his benefactor to commence medical work in Chateau for the assistance of other sufferers. This seemed very like the guidance they were seeking, especially when the mandarin, in the grateful spirit so characteristic of his people, undertook to help them about premises. Backed by his approval, they were soon enabled to rent the entire house in which they had hitherto occupied a single room, which gave them the advantage of beginning in a neighborhood in which they were already known and respected. As though the shadow of a longer parting lay upon his heart, Hudson Taylor was very reluctant, even then, to leave his loved and honored friend. But when just at this junction a free passage was offered him all the way to Shanghai by an English captain, the matter seemed taken out of his hands. Mr. Burns would not be left alone or without fellow workers. One of the native Christians would assist him in Shangto, and one at Ampo, and in the country districts. It really seemed at last as though the way were opening before them, and all they needed was the medical outfit waiting in Shanghai to enable them to enter upon fruitful labors. And so early in July the parting came, and full of thankfulness for the past and hope for greater blessing in the days to come, they committed one another to the care and keeping that had never failed them hitherto. Those happy mouths were an unspeakable joy and comfort to me. Those happy months were an unspeakable joy and comfort for me, wrote Hudson Taylor long after, looking back upon the companionship thus ended with William Burns. His love for the word was delightful, and his holy, reverent life and constant communion with God made fellowship with him satisfying to the deepest cravings of my heart. His accounts of revival work and of persecutions in Canada, Dublin, and southern China were most instructive as well as interesting, for which true spiritual insight he often pointed out God's purposes in trial in a way that made all life assume quite a new aspect and value. His views, especially about evangelism as the great work of the church and the order of lay evangelists as a lost order that Scripture required to be restored, were seed thoughts which were to prove fruitful in the subsequent organization of the China Inland Mission. For, in the providence of God, they never met again. All unexpectedly, Hudson Taylor found his path diverting from that of his friend. Dark clouds were gathering over southern China, soon to lead to war. On a boat near Chateau, Mr. Burns was taken prisoner and sent under escort by river and canal, a journey of 31 days to Kent, and the nearest British authorities,
Returning to Chateau months later, he was enabled to take advantage of the growing feeling in his favor to establish a permanent work. Known as the man of the book, he was allowed to go in and out freely, the trusted friend of the people when all of the Europeans were confined to their houses and in considerable danger on account of the inquiries of the coolie traffic. And the Chateau mission of the English Presbyterian Church flourishes today as an outcome of those early labors. Passing on to other fields when initial difficulties were conquered, Mr. Burns was led to Peking at length, and there spent 4 years in literary and evangelistic work. And then, true to the commanding vision of his life, the veteran missionary turned his face once more to the region beyond, north of the Great Wall and stretching far away. An almost unknown world lay the fair and fruitful plains of Manchuria. A few foreigners were living at the treaty port, but as yet no minister or missionary was among their number. Footnote. One missionary journey had been made in Manchuria some time previously, that of Dr. Alexander Williamson, who, an agent of the Scottish Bible Society, traversed this important region between the years 1866 and 1868, even reaching a point, San-Sin, on the Sungari River, which the Church has not yet overtaken. See A Century of Missions in China, page 206. End of the footnote. Along with a single native helper, Mr. Burns set out for Newchwang. His life and teaching so impressing the captain of the junk on which they traveled that he would take no fare from the man whose very presence seemed a blessing. Then came the closing days. Setting the seal of God's own benediction upon this life of singular devotion, 4 months of earnest pioneering work, preaching in English on Sundays to the handful of fellow countrymen in the settlement and in Chinese all through the week in the native quarters in which he lived, and after that an illness, the result, as it seemed, of chill, brought the quiet, unexpected end. Footnote. The Reverend William C. Burns passed away on April 4, 1868, just 2 years after the formation of the China Inland Mission, which he had watched with the warmest interest. To the faraway homeland he sent as his last message an appeal to take up the work he had thus was thus laying down, an appeal nobly responded to by the arrival of the first representative of the Irish Presbyterian Mission in the following year, and of the sister church in Scotland 3 years later. The United Irish and Scotch Presbyterian Missions in Manchuria, one Chinese church, now numbered no fewer than 16,075 actual communicants with a missionary staff of 69 Europeans. Thus, blessedly, has the confidence of William Burns been justified. God, he said, will carry on the good work. Ah, no, I have no fears for that. End of footnote. Alone among the Chinese to the last, planting with his dying hand the standard of the cross far afield amongst the darkness, gathering round it those whose hearts the Lord had opened. A little company, loved, prayed for, taught, and comforted, almost to his last breath, who watched beside him as he passed through the valley, learned not only how a Christian should live, but also how he can die. What can be more after the pattern of his whole life, more in keeping with his heart's desire? As Glaze the prophet on a sending car, swept by its fierce steeds of way afar, so with the burning tear and flashing eye, I trace thy glorious pathway to the sky. Lone like the tisbet, as the Baptist bold, cast in a rare apostolic mold, earnest and selfish consecrated troop, with nothing but the highest ends in view, choosing to toil in distant fields unsown, and contented to be poor and little known. Fearful to death, O man of God, well done, thy fight is ended and thy crown is won. God shall have all the glory, only grace, may thee to differ, let us, man, abase. Deep with an emphatic tone, thy dying word, thy last was this, thine is the kingdom, Lord, the power and the glory. Thus the final flame of the burnt offering to Jehovah's name, ascended from the altar, life thus given to God, must have its secret springs in heaven.
O William Burns, we will not call thee dead, though lies thy body in its narrow bed. In far-off China, though Mandarin keeps thy dust, in far-off China, though Manchuria keeps thy dust in which the Lord securely sleeps. Thy spirit lives with Jesus, and where he, thy master, dwells, 'tis meet that thou shouldest be. There is no death in his divine embrace. There is no life but where they see his face. And now, Lord, let thy servant's mantle fall upon another, since thy solemn call to preach the truth in China has been heard. Grant that a double portion be conferred on the same spirit, on the gentler head, on some Elisha who may raise the dead, and fill the widow's cruse, and heal the spring, and make the desolate of heart to sing, and stand the feeble, fearless, since he knows thy host angelic guard him from his foes, whose life and image fair still may be, of Christ of Nazareth in Galilee, of thine, O spotless Lamb of Calvary. China, I breathe for thee a brother's prayer. Unnumbered are thy millions, Father, hear the groans we cannot. O, thine arm make bare, and reap the harvest of salvation there. The fullness of the Gentiles, like a sea, immense, O God, be gathered unto thee. Then Israel save, and with his saintly train, send us Emmanuel over all to reign. H.G.R.A.T.T.A.N. Guinness, D.D. Hudson Taylor, In Early Years, The Growth of a Soul, Part 4, Ningpo, Marriage and Settled Work, 1856 to 1860, Chapter 31, My Thoughts Are Not Your Thoughts. We thank thee, Lord, for pilgrim days when desert springs are dry, and first we knew what depth of need thy love could satisfy. Days when beneath the desert sun, along the toilsome road, over roughest ways we walked with one that won the Son of God. We thank thee for that rest in him, the weary only know, the perfect wondrous sympathy we needs must learn below. The sweet companionship of one who once the desert trod, the glorious fellowship with one upon the throne of God. We know him as we could not know, through heaven's golden years. We there shall see his glorious face, but Mary saw his tears. The touch that heals the broken heart, it never felt above. His angels know his blessedness, his way-wont saints his love. And now in perfect peace we go, along the way we trod, still learning from all need below, depths of the heart of God. Chapter 31, being read by Peter John Parisis, also known as Brian D. My Thoughts Are Not Your Thoughts, July through August, 1856. A brief absence from all that Hudson Taylor anticipated when he parted from Mr. Burns and Chateau. He was badly needing change while the hot season lasted, and this journey to fetch his medicines fitted in very well with the plans they had in view. What was his surprise and distress, therefore, to learn upon reaching Shanghai that the premises of the London mission had been visited by fire, and that his medical outfit, left there for safety, was entirely destroyed. What could it mean? Why had it been permitted? Never had he needed these belongings more. Everything in Chateau seems to depend upon the medical work they were now in a position to undertake, and Mr. Burns was alone waiting for him. But what was the use of returning without medicines? And where was a new supply to come from, or the means to obtain them? Purchase in Shanghai, he could not, on account of the extravagantly high prices of imported articles, and 8 or 9 months might be required before they would reach him from home. It was a difficult position, and the young missionary, as he tells us, was more disposed to say with Jacob, "All these things are against me," than to recognize with cheerful faith that all things work together for good to them that love God. I had not then learned, he records, to think of God as the one great circumstance in whom we live and move and have our being, and of all lesser circumstances as necessarily the kindest, wisest, best,
because either ordered or permitted by him. Hence, my disappointment and trial were very great. The only thing was to write and tell Mr. Burns what had happened, and to put off his return until he could go to Ningpo and see what Dr. Parker could do to help them. If he could spare a small supply of medicines to go on with, they might still be able to begin work as soon as the great heat was over. So in the hope of retrieving his losses, Huff and Taylor set out for the neighboring city. And then a whole set of new difficulties began. 3 or 4 days under ordinary circumstances would have taken him to Dr. Parker, but on this occasion he found himself 3 weeks after he first started, no nearer his destination than at the beginning. True, he had made the trip as much of an evangelistic journey as possible, preaching and distributing literature along the first part of the way. But this was not the reason of his ending up where he began, penniless and destitute, without having reached Ningpo at all or communicated with Dr. Parker. It is interesting to notice, he wrote long after, the various events which united in the providence of God in preventing my return to Chateau and ultimately led to my settling in Ningpo and making that the center for the development of future labors. But during this trying summer and many unsettled months that followed, the young missionary was sorely perplexed to understand the way divine providence was taking in the order of his affairs. Life turns at times on a small pivot, and in looking back, one is startled to realize the importance of what seemed a very little thing. How could Hudson Taylor have imagined, for example, that the robbery that left him in such distress upon this journey was to result in the deliverance of the entire mission he was yet to found during a period of financial danger? How could he suppose that the upset of all his plans and the severance of a partnership and service more precious than any he had ever known was to prove the crowning blessing of his life on the human side, bringing him into association and at last union with the one of all others most suited best to him and his work? But so it is, God leads. His hand is on the helm. We are being guided even when we feel at least the closed door is as much his providence as the open, and equally for our good and the accomplishment of his own great ends. And one learns at last that it is not what we set ourselves to do that really tells in blessing so much as what he is doing through us when we least expect it, if only we are in abiding fellowship with him. There was no water beyond Shih-mun-wan. He wrote in relating the latter part of this journey. Footnote. Up to this point, Mr. Taylor had distributed with his usual care as many as 200 copies of the New Testament and 3,000 other books and tracts. He had been 2 weeks upon his way, July 22nd to August 4th, and was able to write, "Never since I have been in China have I had such opportunities for preaching the gospel." The account that follows of the rest of the journey is taken from letters to his mother and to the secretary of the CES, published in part in The Gleaner for December 1856. End of the footnote. So I paid off my boat, hired coolies to carry my things as far as Chang-an, and before sunrise we were on the way. I walked on ahead, leaving my servant to follow with the men, who made frequent stoppage to rest, and on reaching the city of Shih-mun, I waited for them in a tea shop outside the north gate. The coolies came on very slowly and seemed weary when they arrived. I soon found that they were opium smokers, so that although they had only carried between them a load that a strong man would think nothing of taking 3 times the distance, they were really tired. After rice, tea, and an hour's rest, including, I doubt not, a smoke of opium pipe, they were a little refreshed, and I proposed moving on that we might get on to Chang-an before the sun became too powerful. My servant, however, had a friend in the city and proposed that we should spend the day there and go on the following morning. To this, of course, I objected, wishing to reach Chang-an, the point of embarkation for Ningpo, that night if possible. We therefore set off, entered the north gate, and had passed through about a third of the city when the coolies stopped to rest, saying they would be unable to carry the burden on to Chang-an. Finally, they agreed to take it to the south gate,
where they were to be paid in proportion to the distance they had traveled, and my servant undertook to call other coolies and come along with them. I walked on before, as in the first instance, and the distance being only about 4 miles, soon reached CHAMG-AN and waited their arrival. Meanwhile, engaging coolies for the rest of the journey to HAI-NING, having waited a long time, I began to wonder at the delay, and at length it became too late to finish the journey to HAI-NING that night. I felt somewhat annoyed, but that my feet were blistered, and the afternoon very hot, I should have gone back to meet them and urge them on. At last I concluded that my servant must have gone to his friend and would not appear until evening. But evening came, and still there was no sign of them. Feeling very uneasy, I began diligently to inquire whether they had been seen. Are you a guest from SHIH-MUN-WAN? A man at last responded. I answered in the affirmative. Are you going to Heianing? That is my destination. Then your things have gone on before you. For I was sitting in a tea shop when a coolie came in, took a cup of tea, and set off for Heianing in a great hurry, saying that the bamboo box and bed he carried, just such as you describe yours to have been, were from SHIH-MUN, and he had to take them to Heianing tonight, where he was to be paid at the rate of 10 cash pound. From this I concluded that my goods were on before me, but it was impossible to follow them at once, for I was too tired to walk and it was already dark. Under these circumstances, all I could do was to seek a lodging for the night, and no easy task I found it. After raising my heart to God to ask his aid, I walked through to the further end of the town, where I thought the tidings of a foreigner being in the place might not have spread, and looked out for an inn. I soon came to one and went in, hoping that I might pass unquestioned. Asking the bill of fare, I was told that rice, cold rice, which proved to be more than rather burnt, and snakes fried in lamp oil, were all that could be had. Not wishing any questions to be raised to my nationality, I ordered some and tried to make a meal, but with little success. While thus engaged, I remarked to the landlord, "I suppose I can arrange to spend the night here?" To which he replied in the affirmative. But bringing out his book, he added, "In these unsettled times, we are required by the authorities to keep a record of our lodgers. May I ask your respective family name?" "My unworthy name is T.A.I., I responded. "And your honorable second name?" "My humble name is I.A.-K.O.H., parenthesis James. What an extraordinary name. I never heard it before. How do you write it?" I told him, and added, "It is quite common in the district from which I come. And may I ask whence you come and whether you are going?" "I am journeying from Shanghai to Ningpo by way of Hangzhou." "What may be your honorable profession?" "I heal the sick." "Oh, you are a physician," the landlord remarked, and to my intense relief closed the book. His wife, however, took up the conversation. "You are a physician, are you? I am glad of that. For I have a daughter afflicted with leprosy, and if you will cure her, you shall have your supper and bed for nothing." I was curious enough to inquire what my supper and bed were to cost if paid for, and to my amusement found they were worth less than 3 halfpence of our money. Being unable to benefit the girl, I declined to prescribe for her, saying that leprosy was a very intractable disease and that I had no medicines with me. But the mother brought pen and paper, urging, "You can at least write a prescription, which will do no harm if it does no good." This I also declined to do and requested to be shown my bed. I was conducted to a very miserable room on the ground floor, where on some boards, raised upon 2 stools, I passed the night, without bed or pillow, save my umbrella and shoe, and without any mosquito netting. 10 or 11 other lodgers were sleeping in the same room, so I could not take anything off for fear of it being stolen. But I was by no means too warm as midnight came on. Tuesday, August 5th. Early in the morning I arose, cold, weary, and footsore, and I had to wait a long time ere there were any signs of breakfast. After this there was another delay before I could get a chance for the only dollar I had with me, in consequence of its being chipped in one or two places. More than 300 cash also were deducted from its price on this account, which was a serious loss in my position. I then sought throughout the town for tidings of my servants and coolies.
as I thought it possible that they might have arrived later or have come on in the morning. The town is large, long, and straggling, being near 2 miles from one end to the other, so this occupied some time. I gained no information, however, and footsore and weary set out for Heianing on the full heat of the day. The journey, about 8 miles, took me a long time, but a halfway village afforded a resting place and a cup of tea, of which I gladly availed myself. When about to leave, again, a heavy shower of rain came on, and the delay thus occasioned enabled me to speak a little to the people about the truths of the gospel. The afternoon was far spent before I approached the northern suburb of Haianing, where I commenced inquiries, but nothing could I learn of my servant or belongings. I was told that outside the east gate I should be more likely to hear of them, as it was there the sea junks called. I therefore proceeded thither and sought for them outside the little east gate, but in vain. Very weary, I sat down in a tea shop to rest, and while there, a number of persons from one of the Mandarin's offices came in and made inquiries as to who I was, where I had come from, etc. On learning the object of my search, one of the men in the tea shop said, "A bamboo box and a bed, such as you describe, were carried past here about half an hour ago. The bearers seem to be going towards either the east, great east gate, or the south gate. You had better go to the Hongs, their business houses, and inquire." I asked him to accompany me in my search, promising to reward him for his trouble, but he would not. Another man offered to go, however, and we set off, and both inside and outside the two gates made diligent inquiries, but in vain. I then engaged a man to make a thorough search, promising him a liberal reward if he should be successful. In the meantime, I had something to eat and addressed a large concourse of people who had assembled. When my messenger returned, having met with no success, I said to him, "I am now quite exhausted. Will you help me find quarters for the night, and then I will pay you for your trouble?" He was willing to befriend me, and we set off in search of lodgings. At the first place or two, the people would not receive me, for though on our going in they were ready to do so, the presence of a man who followed us and who I found was engaged in one of the government offices seemed to alarm them, and I was refused. We now went on to a third place, and being no longer followed by the Mandarin's messenger, we were promised quarters. Tea was bought, and I paid the man who had accompanied me for his trouble. Soon after he had left, some official people came in. They did not stay long, but the result of their visit was that I was told that I could not be entertained there that night. A young man present blamed them for their heartless behavior and said, "Never mind, come with me, and if we cannot get better lodgings, you shall sleep at our house." I went with him, but we found the people of his house unwilling to receive me. Weary and footsore, so that I could scarcely stand, I had again to seek quarters, and at length got a promise of some, but a little crowd gathering about the door, they desired me to go to a tea shop and wait till the people had retired, or they would be unable to accommodate me. There was no help for it, so I went, accompanied still by the young man, and waited till past midnight. Then we left for the promised resting place, but my conductor could not find it. He led me about to quite another part of the city, and finally, between 1 and 2 o'clock, he left me to pass the rest of the night as best I could. I was opposite a temple, but it was closed. So I lay down on the stone steps in front of it, and putting my money under my head for a pillow, should soon have been asleep, in spite of the cold, had I not perceived a person coming stealthily towards me. As he approached, I saw he was one of the beggars so common in China, and had no doubt his intention was to rob me of my money. I did not stir, but watched his movements, and looked to my father not to leave me in this hour of trial. The man came up, looked at me for some time, to assure himself that I was asleep. It was dark, that he could not see my eyes fixed on him, and then began to feel about me gently. I said to him in the quietest tone, but so as to convince him that I was not nor have been sleeping, "What do you want?" He made no answer, but went away. I was thankful to see him go, and when he was out of sight, put as much of my cash as would not go into my pocket safely up my sleeve, and made my pillow a stone projection of the wall. It was not long ere I began to doze, but I was aroused by the noiseless footsteps of two persons approaching, for my nervous system was rendered so sensitive by exhaustion that the slightest sound startled me. Again, I sought protection from him who alone was my stay, and lay still as before, till one of them came up and began to feel my head for the cash. I spoke again, and they sat down at my feet. I asked them what they were doing. They replied that, like me, they were going to pass the night outside the temple. I then requested them to take the opposite side, as there was plenty of room, and leave this side to me, but they would not move from my feet. So I raised myself up and set my back against the wall. You had better lie down and sleep, said one of them, otherwise you will be unable to work tomorrow. Do not be afraid, we shall not leave you, and we shall see that no one does you harm. Listen to me, I replied, I do not want your protection. I do not need it. I am not a Chinese, and I do not worship your vain idols. I worship God. He is my Father, and I trust in him. I know well what you are and what your intentions, and shall keep my eye on you and not sleep. Upon this, one of them went away, only to return with a third companion. I felt very uneasy, but looked to God for help. Once or twice, one of them came over to see if I was asleep. Do not be mistaken, I said. I am not sleeping. Occasionally, my head drops, and this was a signal for one of them to rise. But I at once roused myself and made some remark. As the night slowly wore on, I felt very weary, and to keep myself awake, as well as to cheer my mind, I sang several hymns, repeated aloud several portions of scripture, and engaged in prayer. To the annoyance of my companions, it seemed as if they would have given anything to get me to desist. After that, they troubled me no more, and when shortly before dawn of day they left me, I got a little sleep. Wednesday, August 6th. It was still quite early when I awakened by the young man who had so misled me on the previous evening. He was very rude and insisted on my getting up and paying him for his trouble, even going so far as to try to accomplish by force what he wanted. This roused me, and in an unguarded moment, with a very improper feeling, I seized his arm with a grasp he so little expected, and dared him to lay a finger on me again or to annoy me further. This quite changed his manner. He left me quietly remain until the guns announced the opening of the gates of the city, and then begged me to give him something to buy opium with. Needless to say, this was refused. I gave him the price of 2 candles that he said he had burned while with me last night and no more. I afterwards learned he was connected with one of the Mandarin's offices. As soon as possible, I bought some rice gruel and tea for breakfast, and then once more made a personal search for my things. Some hours thus spent I set out on the return journey, and after a long and weary and painful walk, reached Chang-an about noon. Here also my inquiries failed to bring any trace of the missing goods. So I had a meal cooked in a tea shop, got a thorough wash and bathed my inflamed feet, and after dinner rested and slept until 4 p.m. Much refreshed, I then set off to return to the city at the south gate of which I had parted with my servant and coolies 2 days before. On the way, I was led to reflect on the goodness of God and recollected that I had not made it a matter of prayer that I might be provided with lodgings last night. I felt condemned too that I should have been so anxious for my few things, while the many precious souls around me had caused so little concern. I came as a sinner and pleaded the blood of Jesus, realizing that I was accepting in him pardon, cleansed, sanctified, and oh, the love of Jesus, how great I felt it to be. I knew something more than I had ever known of what it was to be despised and rejected, and have nowhere to lay one's head, and felt more than ever I had before the greatness of the love that introduced him to leave his home in glory and suffer thus for me, nay, to lay down his very life upon the cross. I thought of him as dejected and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. I thought of him at Jacob's well, weary, hungry, and thirsty, yet finding it his meat and drink to do his Father's will, and contrasted this with my littleness of love. I looked to him for pardon for the past and for grace and strength to do his will in the future, to tread more closely in his footsteps, and to be more than ever wholly his. I prayed for myself, for friends in England, and for my brethren in the work. Sweet tears of mingled joy and sorrow flowed freely. The road was almost forgotten, and before I was aware, I had reached my destination. Outside the south gate, I took a cup of tea and asked about my lost luggage and spoke of the love of Jesus. Then I entered the city, and after many vain inquiries, left it by the north gate. I felt so much refreshed both in mind and body by the communion I had on my walk to the city that I thought myself able to finish the remaining 6 miles back to Chang-an that evening. First, I went into another tea shop to buy some native cakes and was making a meal of them, when who should come in but one of the identical coolies who had carried my things the first stage. From him, I learned that after I had left them, they had taken my luggage to the south gate. There, my servant went away, saying on his return that I had gone on, that he did not intend to start out at once, but would spend the day with his friend, and then rejoin me. They carried the things to his friend's house and left them there. I got him to go with me to the house, and there learned that my servants had spent the day and night with them, and the next morning had set out for Hang Chau. This was all I could gather, so unable to do anything but proceed on my return journey to Shanghai. With all my expedition, I left the city. It was now too late to go on to CHIH-MUN-WAN. I looked to my father as able to supply all my need and receiving another token of his ceaseless love and care, being invited to sleep on a Hung boat, now dry in the bed of the river. Thursday, August 7th. The night was again very cold and the mosquitoes troublesome. Still, I got a little rest and at sunrise was up and able to continue my journey. I felt very ill at first and had a sore throat, but reflected on the wonderful goodness of God in enabling me to bear the heat by day and night, and the cold by night for so long. I felt also quite a load taken off my mind. I had committed myself and my affairs to the Lord and knew that if it was for my good and for His glory, my things would be restored. If not, all would be for the best. I hoped that the most trying part of my journey was now drawing to a close, and this helped me, footsore and weary, on the way. When I got to the city I destined and had breakfast, I found I had still 810 cash in hand. I knew that the fare by passenger boat to Ka-Shing was 120 cash, and thence to Shanghai 360, which would leave me just 330 cash, 12 pence and a fraction, for 3 or 4 days' provision. I went at once to the boat office, but to my dismay found that goods had been delayed owing to the dry state of the river, and that no boat would leave today, and perhaps none tomorrow. I inquired if there were no letter boats for Keixing, and was told that they had already left. The only remaining resource was to ascribe if any private boats were going in which I could obtain a passage. My search, however, was in vain, and I could get no boat to take me all the way to Shanghai, or my difficulty would have been at an end. Just at this juncture, I saw before me, at a turn in the canal, a letter boat going in the direction of Keixing. This, I concluded, must be one of the Keixing boats that had been detained, and I set off after it as fast as hope and the necessity of the case would carry me. For the time being, weariness and sore feet were alike forgotten, and after a chase of about a mile, I overtook it. "Are you going to Keixing Fu?" I called out. "No," was the only answer. "Are you going in that direction?" "No." "Will you give me a passage as far as you do go that way?" "Still no, and nothing further." Completely discouraged and exhausted, I sank down on the grass and fainted away. As consciousness returned, some voices reached my ear, and I found they were talking about me. "He speaks pure Shanghai dialect," said one from their own speech. I knew them to be Shanghai people. Raising myself, I saw that they were on a large hung boat on the other side of the canal, and after a few words, they sent this small boat to fetch me, and I went on board the junk. They were very kind and gave me tea, and when I was refreshed and able to partake of it, some food also. I then took off my shoes and stockings to ease my feet, and the boatmen kindly provided hot water with which to bathe them. When they heard my story and saw the blisters on my feet, they evidently pitied me and hailed every boat that passed to see if it was going my way. Not finding one, after a few hours' sleep, I went ashore with the captain, intending to preach in the temple of the god of war. Before leaving the junk, I told the captain and those on board that I was now unable to help myself, that I had not strength to walk to Keixing Fu, and had been disappointed in getting a passage today. I should no longer have sufficient means to take me there by letter boat and expensive mode of traveling, that I knew not how God would help me, but that I had no doubt He would do so, and that my business now was to serve Him where I was. I also told them that the help which I knew would come ought to be an evidence to them of the truth of the religion which I and the other missionaries in Shanghai preached. On our way to the town, engaged in conversation with the captain, we saw a letter boat coming up. The captain drew my attention to it, but I reminded him that I was no longer I had no longer money enough to pay for my passage. He hailed it nevertheless and found that they were going to a place about 9 miles from Shanghai, whence one of the boatmen would carry the mails overland to the city. "This gentleman is a foreigner from Shanghai," he then said, "who has been robbed and has no longer the means of returning. If you will take him with you as far as you go, and then engage a sedan chair to carry him the rest of the way, he will pay you in Shanghai. You see, my boat is now laying around for want of water and cannot get away. I will stand surety, and if this man does not pay you when you get to Shanghai, I will do so on your return. There is another boat agreeing to the terms. I bid farewell to my kind friend and was taken on board as a passenger. As I lay down on the bottom of the boat, how soft the planks felt, and how thankful I was to be on the way to Shanghai once more. Long and narrow and built, these letter boats are very limited in as to their inside accommodations, and one has to lie down all the while they are in motion, as a slight movement might upset them. This was no inconvenience to me, however. On the contrary, I was only too glad to be quiet. They are the quickest boats I have seen in China. Each one is worked by two men who relieve one another continuously day and night. They row with their feet and paddle with their hands, or if the wind is quite favorable, row with their feet, and with one hand manage a small sail while steering with the other. The 90 li, 30 miles, a good journey by ordinary houseboat, to Keixing Fu, were soon passed, and shortly after dark we again left the city, letters having been received and delivered by one of the men, while the other prepared our evening meal. Friday, August 8th, morning found us at K-A-S-H-A-N, and while letters were being attended to, I went on shore, had my head shaved, and addressed the people who assembled. We then breakfasted and got off. In the afternoon, we reached Sung-Kiang, and here again, I had a good time preaching in an unfrequented quarter. Saturday, August 9, 1856, about 8 a.m., reached Shanghai and the hospitable abode of Mr. W-Y-L-I-E of the London Mission, completing a journey full of mercies, though not unmixed with trial. Never since I had been in China had I had such opportunities for preaching the gospel, and there the termination was far from what I desired. It has been greatly blessed to me, and I trust the word preached and distributed may bear fruit to the glory of God.
Hudson Taylor, In Early Years, The Growth of the Soul. Chapter 32. Who shutteth and no man openeth. August to October, 1856. And now the question arose as to what was to be done about the servant who had made off, apparently, with Mr. Taylor's belongings. There was just a possibility that official interference might lay at the root of the matter, and that YOH-HSI was in detention in one of the Yemens. Before concluding, therefore, that he had acted dishonestly, a messenger was sent to make careful inquiries. But it soon transpired that the case was one of deliberate robbery. YOH-HSI, own letters bringing the final proof. For the recovery of the property would not have been difficult to institute legal proceedings, and Mr. Taylor was strongly urged to secure the punishment of the thief. But the more he thought about it, the more he shrank from anything of the sort. YOH-HSI was one whose salvation he had earnestly sought, and to hand him over to cruel underlings who would only be too glad to throw him into prison that he might be squeezed to the last farthing would not have been in keeping, he felt, with the spirit of the gospel. Finally concluding that his soul was worth more than the £40 worth of things he had stolen, Mr. Taylor decided to pursue a very different course. "So I have sent him a plain, faithful letter," he wrote in the middle of August, "to the effect that we know his guilt and what its consequences might be to himself, that at first I had considered handing him over and in the matter to the Yemen. But remembering Christ's command to return good for evil, I had not done so, and did not wish to injure a hair of his head. I told him that he was the real loser, not I, that I freely forgave him and besought him more earnestly than ever to flee from the wrath to come. I also added that though it was not likely he would give up such of my possessions as were serviceable to a Chinese, there were among them foreign books and papers that could be of no use to him, but were valuable to me, and that those at least he ought to send back. If only his conscience might be moved and his soul saved, how infinitely more important that would be than the recovery of all I have lost. Do pray for him. In course of time, and far away in England, this letter came into hands for which it was never been intended. Mr. George Mueller of Bristol, founder of the well-known orphan homes, read it with thankfulness to God, finding in the circumstances an amplification of the teachings of the Lord himself. His sympathies were drawn out to the young missionary who had acted in what he felt to be a Christ-like spirit, and from that time Mr. Hudson Taylor had an interest in his prayers. But more than this, as soon as the incident became known to him, he sent straight out to China a sum sufficient to cover Mr. Taylor's loss, continuing thereafter to take a practical share in his work, until in a time of special need he was used of God as the principal channel of support to the China Inland Mission. And all this grew out of one little act, as it might seem, of loyalty to the Master at some personal cost. Only there are no little acts when it is a question of faithfulness to God. And it was just his simple adherence in every detail to scriptural principles that gradually inspired confidence in Hudson Taylor and his methods, and won for the mission the support of spiritually minded people in many lands. This matter settled, it only remained to set out once more to obtain from Dr. Parker the supplies needed for the medical work at Chateau. This time the journey was accomplished in safety, and just before setting out, Mr. Taylor was encouraged by an unexpected letter that relieved him of what might have been financial embarrassment, for he had declined the generous offer of fellow missionaries in Shanghai to subscribe towards replacing the most necessary things he had lost. Their own resources, as he knew, were none too ample, and he felt sure the Lord would provide without drawing upon the little they could spare. The sale of furniture left at the South Gate brought in something, and then, how wonderful it seemed, just as he was starting, came this letter that had been 8 or 10 weeks on the way. "Please accept the enclosed," it said, "as a token of love for myself and my dear wife." And the enclosed was a check for no less than £40 from Mr. and Mrs. Berger. Posted long before Mr. Taylor had left Chateau, it arrived by the very first mail after the robbery. For the promise still holds good, it shall come to pass that before they call, I will answer. And while they are yet speaking, I will hear. Isaiah 65, verse 24. The city of the peaceful wave in which the young missionary found himself proved even more interesting on this occasion than on his previous visit. Footnote: arriving at Ningpo, the city of the peaceful wave, as the Chinese characters imply, on August 25th, Mr. Taylor remained for 7 weeks with Dr. Parker, taking an active share in his work. End of footnote. Then an attack of illness had obliged him to seek the cooler airs of the hills. Now, though it was again summer, he was able to throw himself heartily into all that was going on, prepared by the experiences of another year in China more fully to appreciate both the missionaries and their work. Never before had he realized the comfort and advantage of laboring among comparatively friendly people, not embittered against the missionaries simply on account of his being a foreigner, although there was, of course, the usual ignorance and superstition in Ningpo, and at times much anti-foreign feelings. There was also a large element of interest and even inquiry about the gospel. And then the missionaries themselves, how delightful to be in the midst of so united and efficient a community. In point of time, the two American missions had the priority as well as in strength of numbers, and an interesting feature in connection both with them and with the Church Mission Society was that the pioneers were all still on the field, men rich in experience and devotion. Dr. McGowan, M-A-C-G-O-W-A-N, for example, the American Baptist Union, was still the leader of their important mission, and with Miss Aldersay divided the honor of having been first to settle permanently in Ningpo. With him were now associated Dr. Lord and the Reverend M.J. Milton, K-N-O-W-L-T-O-N, living outside the city wall with brethren, carried on well-organized and extensive operations, extending as far as the island of Chusan, in which they had several converts. Across the river from this group lived Dr. Parker and his friendly neighbors, the American Presbyterians. Splendidly manned from the first, this mission was still represented by its founder, Dr. McCarty, and a group of younger men destined to make their way in China, including Monsieur Wei and Rankin, Dr. W.A.P. Martin, footnote, the first president of the Peking University, author of A Cycle of C-A-T-H-A-Y, and many other works, and now the oldest representative of the missionary body in China, and the late beloved Dr. Nevis. Within the city itself, enclosed by the five-mile circuit of its ancient wall, lived the pioneers of the Church Missionary Society, and Miss Aldersay with her young companions. From the Taoist Monastery with its surrounding moat, Monsignor Cobble and Russell had moved, as occasion required, into school and chapel buildings in various parts of the city, and with their colleague, the Reverend F.F., it's spelled G-O-U-G-H, had established themselves in the affections of the people. So had also Miss Aldersay and her fellow workers, the only unmarried ladies in that missionary circle. In a large native house in the southern part of the city, they were carrying on, it will be remembered, the first girls' school ever established by Protestant missionaries in China. Vivid impressions of the energy displayed by that excellent woman, notwithstanding a feeble frame and frequent ailments, the impression she made on the Chinese, whether Christian or pagan, was profound, the latter firmly believing that as England was ruled by a woman, so Miss Aldersay had been delegated to be the head of our foreign community. The British consulate, they said, invariably obeyed her commands. Several shocks of earthquake, having alarmed the people, they imputed the disturbance to Miss Aldersay's magic power, alleging that they had seen her mount the city wall before dawn of day, and open a bottle in which she kept certain, confined certain strong spirits which proceeded to shake the pillars of the earth. No wonder they thought so. The only wonder is that they did not burn or stone her as a witch. Her strange habits could not but suggest something uncanny. The year round she was accustomed to walk on the city wall at 5 o'clock in the morning, and with such undeviating punctuality that in winter she was preceded by a man bearing a lantern. A bottle she carried in her hand did really contain strong spirits, spirits of hartshorn, which she constantly used to relieve headaches and as an antidote for ill odors. In summer, unwilling to leave her school for the seaside, she would climb to the ninth story of a lofty pagoda and sit there through the long hours of the afternoon, sniffing the wind that came from the sea. At such times, she was always accompanied by some of her pupils, so that her work was not for a moment suspended. So parsimonious was she of time that she even had them read to her while she was taking her meals. Many, indeed, are the households that call Miss Aldersay's blessed, and I can truly say that in a long list of devoted women who have labored in and for China, I know no nobler name than hers. Scarcely less interesting than Miss Aldersay, if one may venture to say so, were the young sisters, Burula and Maria Dyer, who so amply filled their place as self-supporting workers in the school. Born in the tropical sun of the Straits Settlements and brought up in a missionary home, theirs had been an inheritance of no ordinary kind. Their father, one of the earliest agents of the London Missionary Society, came of a family in the government service. Footnote. He was the son of a certain John Dyer, D-Y-E-R, who held a post in the Admiralty about the time of the ascension of Queen Victoria, end of footnote, and was educated at Cambridge for the English bar. Burning with love to Christ, he had left all to go as a missionary to China, the Gibraltar of heathenism, almost as unknown in those days as it was inaccessible. Unable to effect a landing upon its shores, he had devoted himself for 16 years to work among the Chinese in and near Singapore, and especially in the perfecting of a process by which the word of God might go where the missionary could not,
and the printed page be produced with a faculty impossible to thwart. Footnote. To this devoted missionary belongs the honor of introducing a process which greatly simplified the manufacture of movable Chinese type, thus facilitating the way for the rapid production of the Chinese literature for one-fourth of the human race. End of footnote. In this task he had then prospered, and though cut off by fatal illness just after the opening of the treaty ports, when he, with many others, was rejoicing in freedom to enter the land for which they had so long prayed and labored, Samuel Dwyer possesses more than a missionary grave upon his shores, the first to mark that great advance. Acting as secretary to the great missionary conference, the first ever held on Chinese soil, Mr. Dwyer spent a week or more at Hong Kong in August 1843. From my windows, he wrote to his wife in Singapore. Footnote. He was singularly happy in his marriage with Miss Maria Tarn, T-A-R-N, eldest daughter of Joseph Tarn, Esquire, one of the earlier directors of the London Missionary Society. End of footnote. I look across to the lofty summits of the Chinese hills. The sight is almost overwhelming. In my happiest moments, just two thoughts seem to concentrate every longing of my heart. One is that the name of Jesus may be glorified in China, and the other that you and I, and each of our dear children, may live only to assist in bringing this to pass. Cease to feel the intensest interest in the spiritual prosperity of China. I never can. While this blossom has a heart to feel, cease to serve the cause of Christ among the Gentiles, I never may. While I have head and hands to work, I am as happy as I can be without you, though nothing can compensate for the absence of one who is the joy of my heart. Still, I am about my Father's business, and if I may but do something for the evangelization of that benighted man, come sorrow, come joy, come grief, come delight, all shall be welcome for the love I bear to him who bled on the Mount of Calvary. And though even then his work was done, and a few weeks later he was laid to rest beside Morrison in a little lonely churchyard at Macao, M-A-C-A-O, that spirit still lived on both in the son, whose life was subsequently given to China, and in the daughters who had already been several years with Miss Althusser. With an exceptionally good knowledge of the Ningpo manicure, these young missionaries were as efficient as they were beloved and added not a little to the brightness of the foreign community. Such then was the circle into which Hudson Taylor was introduced for the second time by this visit, and greatly must he have rejoiced to see the value set upon his former colleague by its members. Welcomed in a most generous spirit, Dr. Parker had been successful in building up a practice among the foreign residents, the proceeds of which he devoted entirely to his medical mission. Rapidly acquiring the local dialect, in spite of every hindrance to study, he had made the special care of his patients his first work. In this, he was assisted by both English and American missionaries, who took in turn to preach in the dispensary, in which 9,000 patients received treatment within the first 12 months, and to visit the temporary hospital, when, as was not infrequently the case, these labors resulted in blessing. The converts were free to join any of the churches, Dr. Parker declining to influence them and making it very clear that his sympathies were with all. At the time of Mr. Taylor's visit, he was rejoicing in the conversion of a man whose baptism in connection with the CMS had taken place the week before, and was full of thankfulness also for a forward step in the interests of his projected buildings. With money contributed in Ningpo, he had been enabled to purchase a site on the city side of the river, and such a site, open, central, commanding, on the brink of the great waterway and close to the salt gate, with its constant stream of traffic, a better position could hardly have been found for the permanent hospital, and already the energetic doctor was having the ground leveled for building operations. All this, of course, was deeply interesting to the visitor from Shangzhou, who was expecting to return to such very different scenes. "I am now enjoying a season of rest with the friends here," he wrote early in September. "It must be a short duration, however, for Long repose begets indolence and weakness, and ill becomes a soldier of the cross. To me, it would be very pleasant to remain here or at Shanghai, among more civilized and friendly people than we have in Shaotai. But my call is to a more arduous post, and in my dear, devoted brother, Mr. Burns, I have an inestimable companion, whom I shall rejoice to meet again. I sometimes wonder whether I shall ever be settled, and long for permanent work and a partner to share all my joys and sorrows. I think in his own time I shall be so circumcised. Circumstance. The Lord knows, but the only true rest is in following Jesus, whithersoever he goeth. The only satisfaction is in laboring for and with him, and while one longs for quiet, even now after a week of it, I am eager to be at work again, telling of his surpassing love, his glorious redemption, and work he did with all his usual energy in spite of summer heat. Careful attention to the particularities of local speech soon enabled him to make himself understood, even by Ningpo people, and there were so many strangers settled there from other places that he found all the dialects he knew of service. The weather is very warm, he continued in a later letter. Nevertheless, I have been twice in the country, once with Mr. Jones to TSE-KI, and once with Mr. Quarterman to Chin-HAI, and then HEIEN. Today I have been to a small village a mile or two away with Mr. Jones. He took some Portuguese testaments and found three men able to read them, a Singapore man also who could read English and to whom he gave a Bible, while I had an attentive audience to whom I told of pardon, peace, and heaven through the once offered sacrifice of Jesus, leaving with them a number of Chinese tracts and scriptures. Oh, what abundant harvests may soon be reaped here. The fields are white and so extensive around us, but the laborers are few. I do thank God that he has given me such opportunities. I have met with a good many, even from the Formosa, with whom I have been able to speak of Jesus Christ and him crucified. I sometimes wish I had 20 bodies, that in 20 places at once I might publish the saving name of Jesus. The place where the need was greatest, however, had for him the strongest claim, and before the month was over, he was ready to return to Mr. Burns at Chateau. Dr. Parker had fitted him out with medicines, the cost of which had no doubt been covered by Mr. Berger's recent gift and much benefited by his change of work and surroundings. Mr. Taylor was just setting out for Shanghai when a delay arose. Mr. and Mrs. Wei of the Presbyterian Mission had to take the journey too. They would have little children with them, and traveling is always so precarious. If Mr. Taylor could wait a day or two, they would hurry their preparations for the sake of joining his party. He was already escorting Mr. Jones and his little son, newly arrived members of his own mission, and it would mean a great deal to the Weis to travel in their company. Regretting the delay, but having no reason against it, Hudson Taylor waited, and almost a week went by before the final start could be made. And when they did get away, the journey proved especially trying, for the winds were against them, which made the actual traveling tedious, and serious illness in the party caused Mr. Taylor much anxiety. His colleague, Mr. Jones, to whom he had become sincerely attached during the week spent together at Dr. Parker's, developed a painful malady, and as the child was ill too, it meant constant nursing. Early in October, they reached their destination and thankfully exchanged the Girardi boat for a missionary home in which they were received as paying guests. And then, having discharged their commissions and handed over their patients to the care of Dr. Lockhart, it only remained for Hudson Taylor to put his things on board the vessel that was taken into Chateau. Recent letters from that port made him feel afresh how much he was needed. Though not expecting him back till the great heat was over, Mr. Burns had been sorely missing him and was now daily awaiting news of his return to take up the work they had planned for the winter. Providentially, as it seemed, Captain Bowers was again in Shanghai on the eve of sailing, and cordially welcomed the young missionary as his passenger. So with as little delay as possible, Hudson Taylor sent his belongings on board the Geelong and prepared to leave Shanghai, it might be permanently. And then the unexpected happened. A letter from the South coming to one of the members of the London mission made him go hurriedly in search of Hudson Taylor. If he has not started, wrote Mr. Burns, please inform him at once of this communication. It was to the effect that all they had looked forward to in the chateau was at an end for the time being, Mr. Burns having been arrested in the interior and sent to Canton. Happily, he had escaped summary punishment at the hands of the Chinese, but in all probability, it would be long before he could return to the district from which he had been ejected. It was Thursday morning, October 9th. The Geelong was sailing in a few hours for Chateau, and all his things were on board. What could be the meaning of these tidings? Mr. Burns in prison and sent to Canton? The native helpers still in confinement, wearing the terrible CANGUE, and in danger of their lives? The mission premises empty? The British authorities unwilling that they should return? Almost dazed, it all came over him. First one check, and then another. Medicines destroyed, robbery and all it had entailed, visits in Ningpo, delay in getting away, tedious return journey, and now, at the last moment, a closed door, nothing but a closed door, and a dear sick brother waiting to be taken back to the city from which they had come. Yes, there was no question but to go. But what about Mr. Burns? Could it be that all they had looked forward to was not of the Lord? Thine ears shall hear a word behind thee saying, this is the way, walk ye in it. But for the moment, the path that had seemed so clear before them was lost in strange uncertainty.